We just can't seem to get enough of some great authors. Years after they die, we revel in the publication of work that had not previously seen the light of day. So it is with the American author Mark Twain, the creator of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn and so much more. Some of his very personal work is revealed in the newly released book, A Family Sketch and Other Private Writings. The book also features writing from other members of the author's family. The editor of the book is our guest today. Benjamin Griffin is an editor at the Mark Twain Project. Benjamin, thanks for joining us so much.
Thank you, and good morning.
So give us a bit of a background about the Mark Twain Project itself.
The Mark Twain Project is a research unit and publishing unit of the Bancroft Library in Berkeley, California. It's part of UC Berkeley. It's housed within the library there, and it's several things. It's a collection of papers, Mark Twain's personal manuscripts, and it's also, as I said, a publication project. We do a complete edition, which we're in the process of bringing out year by year. And it's going to eventually be a complete scholarly edition of Mark Twain's writings. And the book that we're talking about today is kind of an offshoot of the writings of the autobiography, which the Mark Twain Project published from 2010 to, we're about to conclude publishing it imminently.
Is it volume three that's about to come out?
Yes.
Okay, and then you and Eleanor Smith edited volume two. How big a job to edit an autobiography especially by somebody who's as much of a literary giant as Mark Twain is?
Well, it's all kinds of a job. This is a very special work to have to edit. Just annotating it is a big, and I have to say, a wonderful job, because Mark Twain allows himself in the autobiography to write about whatever takes his fancy. He figures that it's all him. Whatever he thinks of is his autobiography, and so we get to annotate virtually everything under the sun, which are things we may not be experts in, so that takes a lot of effort. And then, too, he left that autobiography, in an incomplete, sort of disheveled condition, and understanding how he meant it to go was a big part of our labor.
Which raises the question not just about the direction that he would have chosen had he been around to guide the work, but just how much material he left behind, not just for the autobiography, but just in general. I mean, are we talking pages or boxes or rooms or what here?
How about a room full of boxes?
That works.
With pages in them? I don't know. I've never thought of a way of calculating exactly how many words he left behind that are in the papers and are not published. But it's a tremendous amount, simply a tremendous amount. There can't be any other great American writer of whom new things are still emerging. Imagine if other works by Melville or by Hawthorne were still coming out. He wrote much, much more than those people. Some people call him a graphomaniac.
He does seem to have had pen in hand just about all through his life.
I don't know if he slept. he claimed that he hardly slept at all, and I think that may be true. And one has to envy his freedom from writer's block, which obviously never afflicted him. Whatever happens to him, he's upstairs writing about it as soon as it happens.
So, good reporter, anyway. You get lots of descriptions of what's going on in his family life, which is what's going on here in A Family Sketch and Other Private Writings. And you list the authors as Mark Twain's Livy Clemens, his wife, and Susie Clemens, his daughter. He had three daughters who lived at least to be adults. And we get to know them, and we get to know members of his family through this particular work. But then here again, we come back to your job as an editor is like, how decide what's worthy of inclusion in a collection like this?
Yes. Well, the germ of it in this case was wanting to publish the family sketch, which the Bancroft Library acquired at auction in 2010.
And at no small expense, I understand.
At no small expense, yes. about a quarter of $1 million.
Wow.
Yeah. And for a 64-page manuscript, that is pretty good. And Mark Twain kept a professional eye on his pay per word, and he would have been very pleased with this result, I think. So I wanted to include that, obviously, and then to make a book of it, more was required, and I thought, well, Small Foolishnesses, which is that should be included. That's a manuscript of his in which he kept anecdotes as they occurred of the children in their developing and, you know, their precocious and funny sayings and things like that, and I think it's a treasure. I had to weigh carefully what to do with the rest of the book. I wanted to include some writing by Mark Twain's wife, Livy. She is not a writer. She hasn't got the writer's vocation. But I thought we should hear from this woman. She's, you know, a pillar of the, she's, you know, one of the two pillars of the family, and she's a very impressive woman in her own right.
One of the issues with Mark Twain himself is you write that he had trouble with endings. Explain that, please.
Well, that's a little impressionistic, I guess, but Clemens literally seems to have written his novels and stories not knowing where they were going. When he felt that he lost the thread of what those characters were going to say and do next, he did what he called pigeonholing the manuscript. He literally had pigeonholes in his office, and he would stick the manuscript away. Huckleberry Finn spent several years in the pigeonhole. Tom Sawyer spent some time in the pigeonhole. I think he literally waited for these stories to dictate themselves to him. And that does lead to trouble with endings if you don't know where your story is going. People have traditionally been unsatisfied with the ending of Huckleberry Finn, which in every other respect, I think, is clearly his greatest book. But as for a whiz-bang ending, which he evidently felt was needed, he came up with an episode in which Huck and Tom try to free, they try to free Jim. And it has not always met with everyone's approval.
No, much more to talk about as far as the current reaction to Huckleberry Finn as part of the context of talking about Mark Twain. The new book is called The Family Sketch and Other Private Writings. Benjamin Griffin at the Mark Twain Project, its editor and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Benjamin, and you can share your thoughts about Mark Twain with us via phone or email. We'll give the number and address when we come back from this break, back on the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin Griffin and you in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our topic today is Mark Twain. Some new writings of his, or writings that had not seen the light of day earlier, are compiled in a new book called A Family Sketch and Other Private Writings by Mark Twain, by his wife Livy Clemens and his daughter Susie Clemens, collected in a book edited by Benjamin Griffin at the Mark Twain Project. Benjamin is our guest on the Exchange, and you can join us with thoughts about Mark Twain and his great volume of work and the quality of it as well. 800-838-3760, our phone number, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I have to say, having lived in both Connecticut and Missouri, both states certainly claim Mark Twain as their own, and it seems like there's no shortage of other states willing to do that as well, Ben.
Yes, he's a big figure for literary pilgrimage, isn't he? People want to actually go to the places where Mark Twain has been, and I guess his writing is very much associated with place.
Very much so, yeah. But, and it's interesting, too, having moved from Connecticut to Missouri and having people say, oh, yeah, you know, he's from here, yeah. Right? And I was like, well, yeah, no.
And in Elmira, New York.
Right.
Mark Twain country, it says.
Oh, really?
This is welcome to Mark Twain country. Well, you know, they have a claim.
Which is where he spent the summers while they were living in the house in Hartford. Interesting setup there at the farm, as you outline in the book. And he got his own little writing house, it seems like. What was that all about?
Ah, well, I think that was about a dream come true for anybody who is a writer and wants a space. His sister-in-law owned this farm, and they spent the summers there, as you said, with the children. And, yes, she built a little octagonal study for him up the hill from the farm where he could be alone and have a commanding view of the Chemung River Valley. And he wrote several of his most famous works there, including parts of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn.
Part of the issue with getting him away from the house was she didn't want the cigar smoke in the house either, right?
That's right. That's absolutely right. And, I think it was... But he says that the children were running around through his study all the time anyway. It was kind of a place was lousy with children. I don't know how much peace and quiet he actually received.
All right. But certainly apart from the rest of the house. I want to come back to the discussion of Mark Twain and endings and pigeonholing things. Mm. As familiar as you have become over the years with his work, I wonder if you're now able to pick up, almost psychic threads in the sense that you can sense that he wrote the ending for story B when the events of his life were coming, when he was working on the middle of story D, that sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. The more you know about Clemens's life, the more transpicuous, the more transparent the fictional writings become. And it can be, maybe it's a temptation that one shouldn't always yield to say, this is George. This character is George. This black servant is obviously George Griffin, of Clemens's own butler at the Hartford House. And we do that a lot, I think, in Mark Twain studies. We say that St. Petersburg, the town that he writes about in Missouri, which is fictional, we say that it is Hannibal. You know, St. Petersburg, of course, is Hannibal. But it isn't. It's never, reality is never reality anymore once you fictionalize it. And in a way, I think we should probably try to resist the temptation to look through his works. That said, these personal writings that are in this book, he laid under contribution in some of his fiction. There's a late story in which he uses large amounts of anecdotes of his daughter Susie's life as a child, and he really copied word for word, basically, out of the private writing that you can see here. And so the two are completely intertwined.
The piece called A True Story, repeated word for word as I heard it. How did this break new ground for Samuel Clemens / Mark Twain?
This story, which relates the life story of a servant at Elmira, a servant at Quarry Farm, Aunt Rachel, he calls her in the fiction, is new ground in a couple of ways. It's new ground for Mark Twain. This was 1874, comparatively early in his career. And this was his first publication in a major, well, I don't think it was his, actually it wasn't his first publication in an East Coast monthly magazine, but this was the Atlantic Monthly, and the Atlantic Monthly was the flagship publication of American literature. It was edited by William Dean Howells, who became a close friend and sort of semi-collaborator. This was a very prestigious publication, which was read by a lot of people. And then, too, this is a landmark story for Twain because it is his first exercise in doing black dialect. He has the bulk of the story is told by Aunt Rachel in what he calls her own words, which are, of course, his words. But he knows the dialect well, and he manipulates it well. And I think it obviously this looks forward to his important representations of dialect in Huckleberry Finn, where the dialect is not black, but this is a very distinctive feature of American realism, and he's pioneering it in this story.
There are some bones you pick with what the Atlantic did to the original publication of the piece. What was it that the editors did that mangled it, in some people's opinion?
Yeah, well, of course, they didn't have any. The editors of the magazine didn't have any malice aforethought. They were what they were doing was subjecting the story to house style. The Atlantic had a house style, and they say, well, we don't spell the word this way; we spell it this way, and they added a lot of apostrophes to Clemens's representation of dialect, where letters were omitted, so that ain't might have two apostrophes in it because that was Atlantic House style. Huh. And I've reversed all that and tried to bring the textural quality back of Clemens's own manuscript, which I think is perfectly sufficient. And we don't want to read it the way the Atlantic styled it, not anymore.
Well, the obvious questions for you then. I mean, how you decide what to keep of syntax, spelling, and things that might have actually been errors versus things that were intentional.
Well, yes, and that is the editor's task, and there is a trade discourse built up around that, and what you're touching on is the distinction between what we call substantives and what we call accidentals. Substantives is, so to speak, the word itself, and the accidentals is the various ways the word might be spelled, might be punctuated. And that's we exercise these distinctions if we can.
And Twain wrote everything longhand, is that right?
Yeah, he fooled around with the typewriter immediately when it was invented, and he thought it was fascinating, but he never liked typing or learned to type. He did have all his manuscripts typed by somebody for submitting to a publisher, but yes, he wrote longhand, very very fluently, very clearly. I'm grateful for that because I spend my life reading his longhand.
I was about to ask whether this is a lot of time spent with gloves on, flipping through pages of material that he wrote way back when.
Yes, it is. It's a life spent in the archive, trying to piece together publications out of what he left behind.
I'm going to guess you don't have much of a suntan.
No, never did.
We're talking to Ben Griffin at the Mark Twain Project about a new book out of writings by Mark Twain and members of his family. It's called The Family Sketch and Other Private Writings by Mark Twain, Livy Clemens, and Susie Clemens. Livy, his wife, Susie, his daughter. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Talk about Mark Twain, reading his stories, the current context of Mark Twain, particularly as it relates to Huckleberry Finn. Much discussion about that in recent years. Join us at 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area. 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So let's reset the nuclear family here for us around Samuel Clemens, his wife Olivia, and three daughters that live to be adults?
That's right.
Susie, yes. Clara, and Jean. One son died, I guess, at 19 months?
Yes, that's right. Langdon, the son.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in running a home, in raising a family, how typical or unusual were the Clemenses for their time, from what you've been able to ascertain?
I think a mixture. I mean, any situation, any family in which the father is Mark Twain is going to be somewhat unusual. When you read Susie's biography of him, which is in the book, when she wrote this biography of her father when she was 13, he had just turned 50, and he had just completed Huckleberry Finn, and he was being celebrated all over the world. So they have a celebrity father, and it's that kind of a household with everything that entails. Which probably entails some resentment, I think, at times on the children's behalf. So, on the other hand, I do think that his intention and Libby's intention was to keep a normal Victorian American household. The children are tutored in the ways of righteousness. They are disciplined firmly. They are being brought up to be ladies. Just because Mark Twain had a rough and tumble childhood out in Missouri doesn't mean that his daughters get to have any leeway. They are being brought up as Hartford, Connecticut proper young ladies. That's the chief aim of the household.
Were they society ladies in that sense? I mean, were they debutantes or anything to that point?
That's an interesting question, and I don't know I'm not familiar enough with debutante life, perhaps, to say how much it has changed. But they were certainly of the topmost crust of the social cake.
It's interesting too the way you bring forth the things that he said about them, that they were meant to not really do anything.
Yes,
and yet he really insisted upon them getting good educations.
Yes, somebody questioned whether I should cite that phrase by Clemens because it's a joke. The phrase is he said, you know, I have brought my daughters up as young ladies who aren't able to do anything, and they said should you use that because that's really a joke, and I said, well, I don't think it is entirely a joke. And anyway, when he said it, he was testifying before a congressional subcommittee, so I think he may have been choosing his words more or less carefully.
Why was he testifying before a congressional subcommittee?
He was interested in copyright. In the 19th century there was a long and arduous agitation to obtain international copyright for works published in America. And Clemens, who had big overseas sales that he didn't realize anything on, was very interested in this.
Really? So all the stuff he sold overseas, didn't make the proceeds didn't end up in his pocket?
Sometimes they did and sometimes they didn't, but it took a lot of personal work by him to forge relationships with foreign publishers and to go around bringing lawsuits trying to stop piracies.
Not surprisingly, we have a few callers who would like to talk about Mark Twain and some of
All
his
right.
work. Here is Jay in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin Griffin.
thank you. Just briefly, I would like his comments on a book that was profoundly valuable for me when I was a teenager. It saved me from fundamentalist thinking, called Letters from the Earth. And thank you very much for your work.
All right, Letters from the Earth. Thanks for that, Jay. Appreciate it. Benjamin, what can you tell us about Letters from the Earth?
Letters from the Earth is a work that Clemens wrote in manuscript and didn't publish. It would hardly have been possible, I think, to publish it for him. He didn't, as he once said, he didn't want to be crucified just yet. Letters from the Earth is strongly anti-fundamentalist religion. It takes the form of a series of letters by the devil, written back from his examinations of our world, walking up and down in it. It is indeed a farrago of deep satire on the human race and on religion particularly. It was published in, I think, 1963 as a volume which became very popular at that time. That was just after Clara Clemens, this only surviving daughter, died. She would not allow this to be published. She said it misrepresented her father's opinions. Of course, it consists of her father's opinions, but Clara didn't see it that way. I'm glad that Jay enjoyed it, and I'm glad it saved him. That's not work that I did, of course, but not my editorial work, but I'm very glad to hear it.
I'm curious about that. So she didn't want Letters from the Earth to be published, and yet it did get published after she died. There are lots of people we hear about who we just wonder about their unpublished work because they ordered their papers to be burned upon their death. I gather Mark Twain didn't do that.
No. Actually, there's a very early letter when he had just started to be a professional writer where he says, you'd better burn this letter after I'm dead. I don't want any literary remnants of me being published after I'm gone. But I don't think he meant it. And in fact, in the autobiography, there's a couple of places where he says that he's burned things that he actually didn't burn. That's the sort of thing we handle in the annotation. It's puzzling, but he's always got a sort of back and forth game going on about whether he wants his work tidied up and made fit for proper consumption, for propriety, and or whether he wants to shock everyone right out of their seats. And he wants both, and he sort of rockets back and forth between those poles, I think.
It's interesting that Jay called and asked about Letters from the Earth when he did, because I was looking at a question here in front of me about the aside you make in the introduction about the family approach to religion. Interesting treatment of religion within the household itself.
I think this book is really interesting on the subject of religion, as you get an inside view of Clemens's view of the girls growing up and what they are taught about religion and what they deduce on their own. And one of the great anecdotes in it is where Susie, aged, I don't remember what, I haven't got it right in front of me, but aged 4 or 5, said that she's stopped praying, and she's questioned as to why she has stopped praying. And she says, well, I've been learning about the Indians and from her governess, and now they had a lot of gods, and we now know that they were wrong in their religious beliefs. And by, it can turn out that we are wrong in our religious beliefs. And it's a pretty precocious statement. Anyway, she, in her own person, she kind of recapitulates what happened with the history of religion, in which finding out that other people studying comparative religion often was the thing that made people doubt the dogmatic side of their own faith. And she, Clemens is obviously pleased that Susie is precocious, and he must be fascinated that she is recapitulating the history of thought.
Susie does seem like a real precocious child as you read through, yes, through the portions of this book dealing with her, that she just was able to make observations that much older souls probably would have made in those circumstances when she was still in the single digits.
Yes. Susie was a very fiery and a very serious person. She's very much Clemens's favorite child, and it was a catastrophe when she died at the age of 24.
Meningitis, wasn't it?
Spinal meningitis, yeah.
And was that part of what prompted him to do some of the work in this book?
Yes, It's what prompted the family sketch. The family sketch published here is an outgrowth from a much larger collection of manuscripts that are all about Susie, and that he wrote in the immediate aftermath of her death, and he kept working at it for some years. And that was going to be a little book, he thought, commemorating Susie, and to be given just to family friends. This book never actually came about, and that mass of manuscripts is unfinished. But the family sketch is finished, and this is kind of a side road that turned out well. It's partly about Susie, but of course it goes on to discuss the servants and the other children and the animals, and it becomes a real panoply of characters.
All kinds of stuff to revel about in the book, A Family Sketch and Other Private Writings by Mark Twain, Livy Clemens, and Susie Clemens, put out by the Mark Twain Project, where Benjamin Griffin, our guest, is an editor and the editor of this book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from the break. Back with Benjamin Griffin, Mark Twain, and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Benjamin Griffin. He's an editor with the Mark Twain Project, assembling Mark Twain's writings and putting them out to the public. And there's a whole new book on that very vein. It's called A Family Sketch and Other Private Writings by Mark Twain, Livy Clemens, his wife, and Susie Clemens, his daughter. Some really intimate writings from the Twain family. You can join our discussion on the Exchange as we talk about the book and the writings of Mark Twain. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. 800-838-3760, email address jx@jeffnet.org. Here is John and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin Griffin.
Hi. I'm a big Mark Twain fan, and I've always wondered why he seems so contemporary now, and maybe it's just because I like him, but he doesn't seem as dated as some of the other authors. You know, I don't want to hit Dickens, but he just seems like he was more popular in his time. So what is it, if there is anything, about his style that made him fresh and popular then, but he still feels that way now?
All right, good question. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it.
That's a really good question that I've often asked myself. I don't know that I really have an answer for that. I think you just raised all the essential points. When we say something feels contemporary and feels fresh, what do we mean? I think I have a sort of impression that Mark Twain's writing style, just as writing, just the music of his writing, is something, it feels like there are writers who go around and around the subject, or they delineate a subject, whereas Clemens's writing is like seeing the nail hit on the head again and again. You know, nail, nail, nail. And it's just there's great pleasure in his strength and swiftness of and accuracy of his writing. But that's so impressionistic. I don't know if that's any help to anybody. And you raised another one, John, about if it seemed so fresh in 1874, why does it seem the same kind of fresh today? I think we feel like it does, and I think that's a great wonder. But I maybe someday supercomputers will analyze the rhythms and the tonalities of writing and speech in a way that will tell us. But I'm not anxious for that to happen.
Right. We could just kind of figure it out for ourselves in the meantime.
Yeah. And but in the end, it is impressionistic. But that, you know, in literature, impression is everything. So.
Well, I, too, was struck instantly in A Family Sketch in particular by he just gets right to the point. There's a lack of airs or formality right off the top. Susie was born in Elmira, New York, in the house of her grandmother, Mrs. Olivia Langdon, on the 19th of March, 1872. And after tasting and testing life and its problems and mysteries under various conditions and in various lands, was buried from that house the 20th of August, 1896, in the 25th year of her age.
Mm.
One sentence encompassing an entire life.
Yes,
but with a great deal of flavor.
It could be an epitaph. It's Yes, there is slavery. It starts off being reportage. It starts off sounding like a simple report of the facts, and then as the sentence unrolls, you find that it is more supple and that it goes. I have nothing to say, really. I can't add anything. I shouldn't try to add anything to his writing like that.
You can't add to Mark Twain, true.
No, I don't. As an editor of Mark Twain, I am sometimes under that charge.
Right, yes.
Adding to Mark Twain. People ask, when I say I'm an editor of his work, they say, you mean you're shortening them? No. If anything, I'm making them longer.
The annotations, that must be a heck of a process, though, to try to put everything in context. And often I notice that some of your footnotes are annotations provided by Mark Twain himself.
Oh, that's right. Yes, he annotates himself as well. The footnote is one of his favorite things, together with the parenthetical statement. He's a master of all these things. I want to go back for a second and say that I think that his style, which is so unflowery as a rule, is perhaps... It comes from the fact that he comes not out of the literary and university-trained literature traditions of his time, but comes out of journalism and reporting. It may have to do with that. From a very early age, he was a newspaper writer, and I think that has a lot to do with his preference for a direct, simple, nail-on-the-head statement.
You know, but even more direct, I think, than even people of his time, because reading the reportage in that first sentence, which is also the first paragraph of a family sketch, I mean, it is still so much more to the point versus, for example, the paper in Medford, the Mail Tribune, having turned 100 a few years ago, now publishes 100 years ago today in the Mail Tribune. And the writing is often clumsy and flowery and uses strange adjectives and things like that. And Twain doesn't seem to use any of those.
That's true. Everyone should try to read one of the. Everyone should, who's interested in this, should try to get hold of an old number of one of the magazines that Mark Twain was published in, like the Century Magazine or Harper's Monthly. And when you see him in the context of his peers, it becomes even more startling.
Absolutely. So Susie was again Clemens' oldest surviving child, and then she died at 24. Was she the apple of his eye just for being the first, or is their relationship a bit more complicated?
Oh, I think it's more than the fact that she was the first. I think he saw a lot of himself in her. Frankly, she was very much Mark Twain's child. You can see it in her eyes. Every photograph I've ever seen of Susie, she is glaring at the camera. Even when there's a picture of her as a 18 month old infant. In this picture.
Is it that young? I remember that one.
Already doing it, you know?
Oh, yeah, it really is a glare at the camera.
Looks like, I bet the photographer had a hell of a job that day.
Probably.
And she has his passion and his fire, his tendency to want to get right to the absolute truth of the situation, and she has a very uncompromising spirit.
Oh, yeah, here's the picture, 17 months.
I think he loved her and admired her character and loved and admired his own character, to be fair, and saw a lot of it in her.
See, you get the sense, as the field expands, as we go further into a family sketch and other private writings and learn more about not just Susie but other members of the household, that Clemens liked having other witty people around him.
Yes, he delights in it. He would have been devastated if he had had a family of unwitty people. Everyone was witty. It was the currency of the time, this world without television and without radio and without all the things that we come to expect. Conversation was the main pastime. And yes, it's a very rich verbal world that we find ourselves in this book, I think.
What was the term that some people use about Twain? Graphomaniac?
Graphomaniac, unable to stop writing. Yeah,
but it seems like he never ceases to notice and examine the things around him. I notice that about any good writers we've talked to is that their powers of observation are quite acute, and his awe of other people is profound, and it comes shining through in this work, like the part Egyptian wet nurse. Tell us about her and his descriptions of her.
Oh, Maria McLaughlin. Not one of the best known of the Clemens family servants, but maybe she will be now. There's an extraordinary description of Maria. He calls her the Egyptian. I think he just means that she's black or part black. Egyptian is probably just a sort of comical circumlocution. She's almost certainly not an Egyptian, and her name is McLaughlin, so she's Irish to some degree. The servant class in Hartford, Connecticut at this time was partly Irish and partly black, and partly German. So he writes a little bit about that, too, about the different sects of servants warring with each other below stairs. But anyway, yeah, Maria is, well, Clara needed a wet nurse, and Maria was engaged, but Clemens, I won't try to paraphrase this, but he gives a deathless description of the way that, of the intake of Maria McLaughlin, what she drank and ate out of his larder, the beer and the whiskey and the tobacco and the, you know, everything, and how the best part of the story for Clemens is how Clara the baby thrived on this diet, this highly toxic diet as it sounds.
If you read nothing else in this book, I do highly recommend that part because the description of all the intakes of Maria, and then Maria tromps upstairs and goes and breastfeeds his daughter, and she's just fine.
He says she perfectly delighted the baby with a banquet that ought to have killed it at 30 yards.
That is a great line.
Yep.
How much now? So, given that he always has these he's beguiled by people. It seems like he's just really impressed by people and the things they are capable of doing. But you know, given all the works of Samuel Clemens that you have read, I mean, is he ever particularly critical of people?
Oh my goodness, yes. Oh my gosh, yes. Clemens had a big capacity for friendship and a big capacity for failed friendship. Very often when he became close to someone, he would then later turn against them for real or imagined offenses. And it's hard for me to get to the rights and wrongs of it at this date, but I can tell you that someone like Bret Hart, who was a close friend in the early days, becomes a lifelong demon to him. The autobiography in particular has many long passages of denunciation. Very colorful, very interesting to read, but yes, that is the other side. He has big enthusiasms, and when they turn sour, he writes about that too.
All right, so he's a guy who can bear a grudge.
Oh, absolutely.
Let's take a call from another John, this one in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin Griffin, the editor of A Family Sketch and other private writings.
Hi, when I was in Tahoe recently, I read a small book about a lot of characters and famous people, and I understand he was there. Is that right? And if so, tell us a little bit about that.
Mark Twain in Tahoe. Okay, good subject matter. Thanks, John.
Mark Twain was briefly in Tahoe. He was camping. He was camping out there. I'm afraid I don't have anything really to say about it.
All right, but just that he was there, we know that much.
He was indeed, yes. He had been to Lake Tahoe. He thought it was the most beautiful place on earth. That's what he kept saying. And in his book called Roughing It, he writes about Tahoe. And he insisted, by the way, on the name Lake Bigler, which was what it was called before it was renamed.
Really?
He did not like this Tahoe idea, no. He liked Lake Bigler.
How many different countries did Twain visit? Is there a good count on that?
Oh, gosh.
But he was a world traveler.
Seems like nearly all of them, and that's something that surprises people sometimes if they think of Mark Twain as sort of an American, a quintessentially American guy, sort of a Cracker Barrel philosopher outside the store, you know, outside the storefront. Clemens lived many years in Europe. He lived in Vienna and London and Paris and Berlin. He traveled the world. There are some places. I don't know how many countries he visited. It would be interesting to top them all up.
Given how well traveled he was and how aware of things around him, I mean, how much do events in the world outside of his writing study intrude into his work?
I'm sorry, my puppy is barking, and this is his first ever appearance on Oregon Radio.
Oh, well, glad to have him here. Yes, we've had a few crying babies on here as well. How much do events of the world around him, you know, current events, do they get into Mark Twain's writings? Just, you know, his personal stuff around the family and things like that.
Yeah, I think you'll find there's a lot of it in this book. That's especially in Susie's. Well, actually, not in his writing, but in Susie's biography, you're getting a sort of day by day account of 1885, and all the things that are happening then. They go to New York and they walk across the brand new Brooklyn Bridge for the first time. General Grant is dying, or the ex-president Grant is dying, or has just died. In 1885, Clemens records the stages of it, sort of blow by blow. There's quite a lot of Grant. There's quite a lot of U.S. Grant in this book, as a matter of fact. And Clemens never stopped being deeply involved with the events of the day. They were grist to his mill as a writer, and they were subjects for conversation. And there's a very public life. What you're seeing here in this book is, I guess, the private side of a very public life.
But some of the very, very private things that are discussed in here, like in a record of the small foolishnesses of the kids, just delightful at times, such easy sketches of activities, including Clara, who was called Bay, her first spanking, which she seemed to think was a great adventure going into it.
I could read that out if you have time.
I got about a minute.
Oh, no, then you don't have time.
All right, sorry. Darn, I should have brought that up
Missed
sooner.
Missed it. Okay, buy the book.
Right. Just a lot of the out-of-the-mouths-of-babe stuff here. I mean, would he have been impressed with any kids, you think, at that age, or just because they were his kids?
He likes little children. No question. I think he likes precocious children in general. But, of course, his own are special.
Well, this is some great stuff in the book. It's not just the writings of Mark Twain, but the writings of members of his family as well. A Family Sketch and Other Private Writings by Mark Twain, Livy Clemens, and Susie Clemens, put together by the Mark Twain Project, where Benjamin Griffin is its editor. Thanks so much, Benjamin, for joining us today to talk about Mark Twain.
Well, thank you.
It's been a real pleasure. And that'll do it for today's Exchange. You can find out more about the program and suggest a guest at jeffexchange.org. We provide show topics and recordings on our Facebook page as well. Same links available on Twitter. If you're listening in the morning, The Takeaway is coming up next. Our evening rebroadcast is followed by news from the BBC. The producer of the Jefferson Exchange is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant, Megan Mercier. At the controls today, Colleen Pike. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Join us again next time and have a great day.